Welcome to Data and Perspectives, the potential role of TROP2 and CDH6-directed antibody drug conjugates in gynecologic cancers. I'm Dr. Kathleen Moore, and I'll be moderating our exciting meeting today. I'd like to introduce our faculty for today. To my left, you can see Dr. Bradley Monk and Dr. Ramez Eskander will be joining us for the conversation. Here are the relevant faculty conflicts of interest for Dr. Eskander and Dr. Monk and myself, and these will be all available to you if you wish to peruse them. Here's the commercial support for our program today. Research to practice CME planning committee staff and reviewers have no conflict of interest to disclose. This program will contain discussion, mostly actually, of non-approved uses of agents and regimens. Please refer to official prescribing information for each product for approved indications. So this is just what we're going to be doing today. And this is where we're headed today. We're going to cover a lot of ground in 90 minutes. So I'm going to begin, start us off with a discussion of CDH6 or cadherin-6 targeting antibody drug conjugates. Dr. Eskander then will take us through TROP2 targeting antibody drug conjugates, and Dr. Monk will finish with adverse events with antibody drug conjugates. So a lot to cover in a very short period of time, and we have lots of cases to sort of make some points as we proceed through as well. So we're going to start with module one, and I'm going to kind of get us off with just a discussion focused really on cadherin-6 targeting with antibody-drug conjugates. And just to put this in perspective, I think everybody who gives a talk on antibody-drug conjugates starts with this picture now because we like it all so much, and it's already outdated. There's well over 200 antibody-drug conjugates in clinical trials in solid tumors. When we think about gynecologic cancers, this is changing, and I think Ramez is going to speak to payloads a little bit more in his talk, but the original payloads on these antibody drug conjugates kind of from the beginning of ADC, real modern day development, are microtubule toxins like DM4 on mirvetuximab or MMAE. But the majority of what's being developed right now are camptothecins of a variety of types. So this really is the bulk, not all, but the bulk of antibody drug conjugates under development and really what we're going to be focused on today. When we think about antibody-drug conjugates, for those of you that were at the scientific session and heard Dr. Stephanie Guyard, she made this comment using a different figure, but I think we're so excited. The initial signals of efficacy that you're going to hear about are so exciting, especially when you benchmark it against available therapies, that we're just all on the bandwagon of getting these trials open and rolling. But there are some things we have to temper this enthusiasm with. What are the toxicities? You're going to hear about that today. What are the biomarkers? And when we're doing all-comer studies, do we still need biomarkers? And will biomarkers help us individualize when there's a number of ADCs available to our patients, which one's best for this patient at this time? And then one question that we're going to get to in some of our cases and discussion today is, can we sequence? Well, should we? And how do we sequence in the future so we can best serve our patients and help them live the longest and highest quality lives? These are a lot of things that we just don't know yet as the trials are really just getting launched. So let's just talk about targeting cadherin-6. There's three medications targeting cadherin-6 in a clinical trials. I'm going to focus on the one that's furthest along, raludotug deruxtecan. So this is an antibody-drug conjugate, targets cadherin-6 or CDH6. It's conjugated to a deruxtecan payload, so a camptothecin payload, with a drug antibody ratio of 8. This is the data from the phase 1 study that I was fortunate enough to lead that really gave us one of our first signals of how active this agent could be, with an overall response rate close to 50%, which is exciting. But even more exciting, I think, to those of us who take care of patients is the duration of that response was just under a year on the median. And the median progression-free survival, so that includes all patients on the clinical trial, was about 9 months, which is a single-arm study, so you can't overinterpret, but is a very nice signal that not only are patients' tumors responding, but they're responding for a clinically relevant period of time. And that hopefully leads to longer overall survival. This data led to breakthrough therapy designation by the U.S. FDA for patients with CDH6 expressing platinum-resistant ovarian cancer, which Since we think CDH6 is ubiquitous, that's basically all patients with platinum-resistant ovarian cancer, and really jump-started development of this agent. This is now in a registration-enabling clinical trial called Rejoice Ovarian 01. This has two parts. The first part, you've heard the results of at ESMO by Isabel Ray-Coucard last year. This was the dose optimization phase two randomized study of three dose levels that also incorporated a very robust biomarker interrogation comparing archival tissue to proximal tissue biopsies to really understand the temporal heterogeneity of cadherin-6 and how important is cadherin-6 level 2 response rate to really tweak that phase 3 study that's now open and enrolling to be the best design study we can hope that it will be. So these were the response rates from that randomized phase 2 study. So this is the waterfall plot that shows all three active dose levels that were tested, and you can see here all dose levels were very effective, although there was a gradation from 4.4 up to 4.8 up to 6.4. I flipped the numbers a little bit, with a 44% response rate all the way up to 57%. But overall, very few patients who participated on this clinical trial at any dose level had their best response be progression, which is a very nice waterfall. It's a waterfall plot, you know, I want for my patients. And so you might say, well, gosh, 57% response rate, that's the dose, you know, that I would want to give my patient. Well, let's come back to that, because that's actually not the dose that's moving forward. The dose that's moving forward is 5.6, and I'll show you that why in a minute. Number one why is that it's effective. Is it the most effective? No, but it's really pretty effective. You can see there was no difference in time to responses, so patients benefited very quickly, which is what we want to see in our population, where these patients often have symptoms, and they feel better 6 weeks in when their tumors are smaller. But here's really where the dose-driving decision was made. I'm not showing you the PK data because I don't know that you all were interested in seeing the PK. But the PK was important too. But it really comes down to safety. And while all three doses were, I think we would say, safe, the best efficacy-toxicity balance was found at this 5.6 milligram per kilogram IV every three-week dose level where we had the lowest rates of hematologic toxicities comparing 5.6 and 6.4. And both arms had low rates of ILD, but it was half as frequent in the 5.6 dose range. So that became our, 5.8 milligram per kilogram dose range. So that became our selected recommended phase 2 and recommended phase 3 dose. So you can see that here a little bit more. I think I have a box. Oh, I don't. It's highlighted in green. You can just see this a little bit more right here that the any treatment-related SAE in that green box, it's 8.3% versus 20% between those two doses. So a significant reduction in serious adverse events, a drop in drug discontinuation because of toxicity from almost 9% to zero, and a drop in ILD, which was an adverse event of special interest, from about 6% to 3%, although we're still following these patients long-term. We also looked at the cadherin-6 expression level to see if there was a correlation with those patients who responded more or less to medication, and thus far, there is no statistically significant or even statistically suggestive correlation between cadherin-6 levels and response, although it is a stratification factor in the phase 3, so we will look at it some more, but at this point, this still is an all-comers opportunity for patients with platinum-resistant ovarian cancer. In a subsequent post-hoc analysis, they also looked at response rates by the number of prior lines of therapy and the types of prior therapy, bevacizumab, PARP, et cetera, and we really didn't see any differences here as well as expected, but this was just presented at ESGO, so I thought you might like to see this. For key adverse events with RDXD, Dr. Monk's going to really go through adverse events quite a bit, but just to show you what we're seeing, nausea is very common, but low grade. So appropriate mitigation strategies up front are critically important to helping patients feel very good while they're taking this medication. We also see diarrhea about 16% of the time. So this is something, again, it's not common, but it's not rare, and we have to make sure patients have had counseling about this so they don't have any accidents. And then we also can see the hematologic toxicities here. We have anemia of any grades, about 60%. Only about 14% have grade 3 or higher, and that's the range where you're normally thinking about transfusions. High-grade neutropenia was only about 16%, and high-grade thrombocytopenia was very uncommon at about 6%. And so we still have to be mindful for hematologic toxicities, but we didn't see any high-grade toxicities here, and there is not an indication for routine use of G-CSF with this medication at this time. Pneumonitis, I've already mentioned, you can see that it's 2.8% at the 5.6 mg per kg level as compared to 5.7 at 6.4 mg per kg. So this is low. I will caution you, though, there wasn't a ton of follow-up on this study when it was presented, so we are still following these patients, many of whom are ongoing, and so this value may change over time, and we may update the risk of ILD moving forward. We are thinking about R-DXd in different settings. This is a very small exploratory study from the phase one that I presented about a year ago, just pulling out those patients who were whose tumors were classified as platinum sensitive on the phase one, which we allowed for patients who are platinum ineligible to come on. So only 18 patients, but a 72% response rate is a nice signal that perhaps we can move these up into earlier lines of therapy. R-DXd is also being evaluated outside high-grade serous in a study called REJOICE Pan-Tumor 01, and there's an endometrial cervical cancer and a non-serous ovarian cancer cohort. You should see results of this perhaps later this year, and this may be expanding into certain subsets in coming times, so keep an eye out for this. I can't tell you the results of this just yet. And so as we think about where ADCs are going to go, you will see a lot of them moving into the platinum-sensitive space. This is just a summary of the data to date, all small numbers, but with very high response rates, giving us some encouragement to move it into this space. But as we do that, we need to be cautious about what the benchmark is for the control arm. What does platinum do in second, third, and fourth line platinum-sensitive recurrent disease? And we really don't know. This is real-world evidence from Rob Coleman, so clinical trial versus real-world evidence, apples and oranges, but the response rate to platinum post-PARP in this later line of therapy is about 20%. So when you put that up against these others, there's something here that needs a randomized controlled trial to sort out. Or platinum-sensitive disease, should we use this as a maintenance therapy? And we will be watching GLORIOSA very carefully to see how this performed. As we see many other studies coming in this space, should ADCs be used as a maintenance in the platinum-sensitive space is a story that is still being told, and we'll see if R-DXd moves into this space. So in conclusion, I'm going to stop here. I think we've seen a panoply of new ADCs. You're going to hear about some more of them in just a moment, with very strong efficacy signals, different safety signals, and really the onus is on us to figure out how to use these safely and sequence them and select them appropriately from each patient. So exciting times to come. And so with that, we're going to move to some cases. It was 1 minute over. I did pretty well. All right, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Monk to take us through his platinum-resistant ovarian cancer case.
Yeah, thank you. These are great times, and I share the enthusiasm that Dr. Moore has just described to us about the antibody-drug conjugates. I'm going to try to be practical, if you will, understanding the reality of what platinum-resistant recurrent ovarian cancer is and how it should be treated. There are four medications here that are very important in this space. Thank you to you, what you've done. Obviously, weekly paclitaxel is the most active single-agent chemotherapy with about a 30% response rate and about a five-month progression-free survival. Bevacizumab was the first targeted therapy approved in ovarian cancer in 2014, and obviously, weekly pac and bev can be used together. Mirvetuximab, approved in March of 2024 in the Mirasol trial, and now, as of February 10, we have pembrolizumab. So we have to understand the reality of these. Next slide. I got it right here. And so when I see a patient, I think it's fairly straightforward. Is the patient in front of me eligible for weekly paclitaxel? Meaning, does she not have grade 2 neuropathy? If she's recently failed weekly pac? And obviously, there's an inconvenience. And if she's not eligible for weekly paclitaxel, then out of the window goes Rosellen B96. Second, bevacizumab. Again, if I think my patient needs bevacizumab, Rosella did not have bevacizumab in it. Certainly, you can use MIRV and Bev, at least in the NCCN recommendation, less than 75%. And point number three, can she tolerate oral therapy? As you know, oral therapies are not always easy in ovarian cancer. And then the biomarker FR-alpha, HER2, and PD-L1 positivity. So if you take those four aspects, weekly PAC eligible, Bev, can she take oral in the biomarker? It's relatively straightforward in my mind. There will be some difficult questions, but it will be the minority. Generally, if you utilize those four key pillars, it'll be straightforward what the right decision is for the patient in an individualized or personalized way.
So let's just open it up to the panel for discussion. Dr. Eskander, do you agree that that's sort of your approach to selection and sequencing of options for your patients with platinum-resistant ovarian cancer? Does that align? And maybe also start with how you even think about a patient's tumor as platinum-resistant or not.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Dr. Moore, for the presentation, Dr. Monk's perspective. You know, as I approach a platinum-resistant patient, I do importantly integrate the components of which their molecular testing informs treatment therapeutic opportunities. So I'm hopeful that everyone is incorporating these biomarkers that have been established to inform therapy that we already alluded to in the prior slide. I also, the premise of platinum resistance in the context of these patients, as you may have suggested, has evolved a bit. And why is that the case? Because we recognize that platinum is still an effective therapeutic strategy for many of these patients. Did they progress while on prior platinum? What was the interval of time in which they evolved from the prior platinum to their recurrence? As we know, sometimes this is just a surrogate for the time interval in which the imaging was requested, whether you imaged them at 5 months and 3 weeks, or if you imaged them at 6 months and 2 weeks. Is there truly a biologic difference in that tumor or not? From a pragmatic clinical care standpoint. Of course, from eligibility to trials, we recognize that there are criteria that we have to satisfy for enrollment. I would also add to that, I think the conversation around the inconvenience from a weekly paclitaxel perspective, you know, I feel like the data should drive our clinical decision-making as we look to offer patients the most effective therapies. And clinical considerations, patient-specific factors, but also efficacy in a difficult-to-treat disease. And so we know that weekly paclitaxel has emerged as a very effective therapeutic option. We recognize mirvetuximab's role in the FR-alpha high population. And so I integrate the totality of that data in informing treatment.
And I think all of us are sort of maybe on the spectrum of being more passionate about clinical trials. You have a little bit of a biased panel up here regarding clinical trials. So I'm not going to ask you if clinical trials are a priority, but can you just talk about how you... either one of you would, you know, we have three new FDA approvals, which is amazing, but we also have a lot of clinical trials. And so how do you discuss with a patient to what extent a trial might be more advantageous for her than an available newly FDA approved regimen? Dr. Monk.
You know, I think we could do a better job in our clinical trials to have in the control arm topotecan, weekly paclitaxel, or liposomal doxorubicin without those other agents really, quite frankly, is not realistic to where we are today. That was my point. So I challenge if our sponsors are here to actually be nimble. I get it. Some of the studies have already enrolled, but there are several that are early on, very early on, and frankly, the FDA is mandating that. So if the trial is rationally designed to integrate the treatments that are practical, then I think a clinical trial is a no-brainer. But I'm not going to put a patient on a clinical trial that's a good candidate for relacorilant if it's not, you know, accounted for in the clinical trial.
So how are you also going to think of, Dr. Eskander, how are you going to think about now we're already having overlapping biomarkers? Mm-hmm. Like, we haven't even gotten a camptothecin available yet, but we already have overlapping biomarkers. So if you have a patient who you determined tumor is not appropriate for platinum, and you do your biomarker testing, and she's PD-L1 positive by the CPS score. She's folate receptor alpha high, and she's appropriate by these criteria for weekly paclitaxel or weekly taxane. How are you going to think about ordering those medications? Like, what drives your decision to start with a weekly taxane-based regimen or mirvetuximab as an example?
It's an excellent question. It's nuanced, of course. I can't sit up here and prophesize that there is a defined answer for every patient in clinical practice. I will say, for me, the totality and the strength of the data is going to help inform my decision. When I look at this patient that's in front of me, I also have to be humble about the fact that the therapeutic strategies that we're employing are for disease control or response for a period of time. These patients are likely going to cycle through several of these treatment strategies. So I feel, I use this phrase, I'm not burdened by these conversations and decisions. I'm blessed by the fact that I have these choices. So for me, it would a biomarker-directed strategy in this patient if they're FR-alpha high, and I believe that there's going to be a therapeutic benefit to mirvetuximab as an example. I will gladly use mirvetuximab as a treatment strategy in that platinum-resistant patient if they're PD-L1 positive. I recognize already in my mind and have conversations with this patient that I have a subsequent therapy available for you, explaining to them the implications of that treatment strategy in combination with pembrolizumab and bevacizumab in the way I practice and manage my patients outside of a clinical trial paradigm.
Dr. Monk.
I want to come back, though, again to reality. I know I'm harping on this. And you didn't mention HER2 because 3+ in ovarian cancer is 5% or less.
I should have had that.
But yeah. let's take the rule rather than the exception. The folate receptor alpha positivity rate, what, 30% maybe?
38%.
So you take 75% of the patients are going to be PD-L1 positive. So now all of a sudden, the overlap really is 20%. So the rule is 80%, there will not be an overlap. So I like exceptions, but I think we need to focus on the more common scenario where there will not be overlap.
I think there's probably going to be more overlap than you are anticipating between these markers, unless there's secret data that's not out there yet. So I do think we're going to see kind of more overlap between them. HER2 and folate are almost mutually exclusive,
right?
3+ and folate receptor alpha high, 2+, there's quite a bit of overlap.
Mm-hmm.
But so let's come back to the kind of platinum resistant discussion of the three trials that we have approved right now and more to come. Are you thinking about options for patients differently based on whether or not they have primary platinum-resistant disease or acquired platinum-resistant disease, or is it too early to make those distinctions based on these clinical trials? Because they aren't necessarily all the same population.
Yeah, I would say I don't have enough data to say that I can make a defined assessment on how, if I would manage those patients differently in the context of available clinical trials. Hopefully in the future we'll understand better how we would subsequently implement strategies to improve outcomes for either of those populations. But for me, I don't know right now.
So for Mirasol, I think it was 3 months primary refractory to get
excluded.
Excluded.
Yeah,
yeah.
So they had to be 3 to 6 months to come on Mirasol. Yep.
But in Rosella and B96, 1 month.
Right.
So there are, because that may not be the best decision. And in fact, if you look at the clinical activity in that 1 to 3 month population, pretty good. Okay, so there are some nuances, as you say, between or among these trials.
And when we talk about clinical trials, other than they're hard to open and, you know, the operational things at our sites, what do you think are the biggest barriers for our patients in participating on the clinical trials that we're so passionate about? And what do you do to overcome those barriers to help your patients access trials? Dr. Eskin, I'll start with you.
So I will start by saying I continue to believe that we can do better with eligibility criteria. I think that there are eligibility criteria that don't meaningfully inform the patient population being treated. I had a patient whose GFR was 52 and the requirement was 60. I don't think I have a GFR of 60 today. But my hope is that as we evolve and a plea to our sponsors, as was made earlier, let's really be pragmatic about eligibility criteria to increase the pool of patients. And just briefly, tissue requirements. We recognize the importance, you alluded to it. We have to do better to understand the relevance of biomarkers. But if we're going to do that, let's make sure our turnaround times are rapid, that we have a way to communicate with our sites efficiently if we need more tissue submitted, et cetera, because delays in initiation of therapy are very anxiety-provoking for our patients and their families, and that can lead to drop-off for us.
Yeah, and I think, just to bring back something that Dr. Monk brought up, that the control arms are often a big deterrent for patients participating in a clinical trial when they recognize that the control arm isn't what I would pick for her, were she not on the clinical trial? And so I think evolution of control arms is going to be incredibly important. But let's move to our second case with Dr. Eskander.
Great, thank you. So this is a patient, 62-year-old, who I've cared for a bit of time now. She presented to an outside hospital regionally in San Diego with progressive right-sided flank pain, abdominal pain, bloating, and nausea. Her past medical history was notable for a stage 1A low-grade adenocarcinoma, non-smoker. She also had rheumatoid, depression, sleep apnea, obesity, and reflux disease. Her surgical history is indicated here, really nothing significantly relevant to her upcoming diagnosis. Imaging showed widely metastatic disease, large volume ascites, carcinomatosis, and concern for small volume malignant pleural effusion. She had image-guided biopsy confirming a high-grade serous carcinoma of Müllerian origin, and pathology was showed grade 3 nuclear features, positive for CK7 and PAX8. In the context of her symptoms and radiographic disease distribution, she was started on neoadjuvant chemotherapy at this outside hospital, with carboplatin and paclitaxel, electing not to incorporate bevacizumab because of their concern for possible bevacizumab-associated perforation, given her disease burden. She received 3 cycles of neoadjuvant chemotherapy and was seen by me around her 3rd cycle of treatment for consultation. We discussed her response. She had a great radiographic, clinical, and biochemical response and was taken to the operating room for interval cytoreductive surgical intervention, had concurrent hyperthermic intraperitoneal chemotherapy with an R0 resection. Her surgical pathology confirmed this to be a left-sided fallopian tube, high-grade serous carcinoma, and her molecular testing is shown above, HER2-1+, folate receptor or FOLR1 80% expression, PD-L1 CPS score of 5. She had a TP53 mutation. I just put this here specific because you guys saw a presentation today showing a therapeutic strategy for Y220C. So please make sure you're paying attention to the exact P53 mutation.
Right.
TMB low, CCNE1 amplification not detected. I spoke to her and afterwards assumed her care, and we treated with carboplatin paclitaxel, adding in bevacizumab with cycle 5, and she did require a 1-level dose reduction of her carboplatin due to thrombocytopenia. While on maintenance therapy with bevacizumab, she began to demonstrate a progressive increase in her CA125. We imaged her with CT and PET CT and showed peritoneal-based disease recurrence, retroperitoneal nodal disease, although unfortunately the anatomic distribution based on her clinical considerations was not amenable to biopsy, and I have pretty aggressive interventional radiologists. She had large ventral wall abdominal hernias as well after her surgery. So we discussed treatment strategies. She had a platinum-free interval of 4 months, and she was FR alpha high, as I alluded to, 80%. And after discussion, we started her on single-agent mirvetuximab in May of 2024. She tolerated her treatment reasonably well. Her treatment-associated adverse events were fatigue grade 1, neuropathy grade 1. She had a period of grade 2 neuropathy, and we dose-delayed her and had a 1-level dose reduction. And she had intermittent grade 1 nausea. She received a total of 31 cycles of mirvetuximab. And I actually remember when I first started her on therapy, she came in with the paper, Dr. Moore's paper, and said, am I going to recur at the median or not? And so we had a big conversation about what that meant and how we educate patients on where in this Kaplan-Meier curve they're going to land. I have no idea. And in April of 2026, about 2 years after starting single-agent mirvetuximab, she had disease progression with rising CA125. So some treatment considerations. She continued to have an excellent ECOG performance status, prior carboplatin paclitaxel Bev maintenance, FR alpha high, prior mirvetuximab, ADC with an MMAE payload. We've discussed already her biomarkers, the PD-L1 CPS score of 5, HER2 IHC 1+, and the question, of course, is what next?
What do you think, Dr. Monk?
Tough, isn't it? So to your excellent point, is this patient really platinum resistant? She had platinum for 2 years. You kind of want to give it again, but it didn't work hardly at all. She's been off bevacizumab for a long time. I kind of like bevacizumab again, because the way I think of it. So I would give her bevacizumab and chemotherapy. I don't know what that chemotherapy... Dr. Moore's asking all the hard questions. We should ask Dr. Moore. I mean, what do you think? I like Bev again. That's all I know.
I was a little worried about the hernias and what was in the hernias, and it makes me a little bit worried with bevacizumab.
A little bit, yeah.
So I wouldn't call her bevacizumab ineligible. And I do like to use bevacizumab as well. I mean, from a standard of care standpoint, she's had mirvetuximab. I think we'd be looking at one of the two taxane-based options or a platinum-based option. Again, I really don't like Cisgem. I think it's really hard on people, but some people love that regimen, and I'm not judging. But, you know, the other thing I've been thinking about, and I have no data, so this is a data-free zone, is if I have MIRV and I have weekly PAC or weekly taxane of some sort, and then I have a trial with a some ADC, which order do I put them in so that I'm rotating the type of drug? So if I've been on a microtubule toxin, I might either favor a platinum-based regimen or an ADC with a topo one, and then I would go to a weekly taxane-based regimen so I'm not doing microtubule after microtubule. But I don't know if that is even, I don't know if that even is important. You know, we don't, we've never sequenced these before. So, but I would try to be mixing up my mechanisms of action and my most alternating side effects. So I didn't compound neuropathy is what I, how I'd be thinking about it.
Yeah. But if you like Bev, you could do weekly pack Bev, Pembro, it's CPS, I think five.
Yeah.
So I kind of, that feels right. Right. Again, based on the biomarker and based on the Bev. Because, again, if you like Bev in this patient, it's not perfect for all the reasons you said. That takes Rosella off the table, right? Because Rosella, Relacorilant, and Bev isn't an option.
She also has rheumatoid arthritis, though, and so you can flare that with the pembrolizumab. So I think we have to be very...
Rheumatoid arthritis.
It would depend on how serious it is. That's an excellent point.
So, and is she on suppressants for that? I mean, I think there's a lot of considerations here that are not... clear. Yeah.
I'll add one thing. So, of course, I have the privilege of caring for this patient. Just like she came in with the Mirasol paper, she came into my office after presentation of Keynote B96. True, God is my witness, true story. And she said, what about this regimen? And so we talked about it. And this is when she was on the mirvetuximab still and hadn't progressed. When we were talking about subsequent lines of therapy, and this goes to the issue about enrollment on trial, we had a trial at our institution. The control arm did not have Keynote B96 in it.
Get it.
And she said to me, but Ram, as we just talked about this, and now it's FDA approved. And what if I get randomized to the control and it doesn't have what you're telling me is the best option?
I think so.
So we had this exact conversation in clinical practice talking about this. Before she was started on that regimen.
So she got B96?
She got her first infusion last week before I left to come to SGO.
Well, hope. She's on a heater. She already hit once.
We'll
maybe
see.
She'll win again.
I don't know.
So let's just talk before we go to the to your presentation, Dr. Eskander. So we've talked about the fact that she actually has standard of care options now that we are excited about, which is a new thing, I think, for all of us. So that's why we do clinical trials. That's why we're here. That's great. We have this panoply of camptothecin ADCs coming. If they prove to be as good as they look like in the phase one expansion cohorts, and so they have to prove themselves, but if they look as good, how do you guys think about, RDXC is what's on the screen here because that's what I talked about, but any of them in this setting, were one of these available, how would you think about a camptothecin payload versus a taxane-based regimen? Would that change your mind, Ramez, or would you still, because she's one to two priors, just go with B96? How are you going to sequence in a camptothecin?
If I have access to an ADC with a distinct payload from a prior exposure, that, to me, biologically, based on the existing data from real world that's being abstracted from current disease settings in which we have subsequent ADC, I would favor that.
Yeah.
Now, I will say that I think that our understanding of subsequent ADC therapy in a patient that's previously exposed is going to evolve. I mean, we just saw from Dr. Pathuri's presentation today that you had prior topo 1 exposed patients who responded to LY417 at rechallenge. So I don't think that question has yet been definitively answered. I'm excited, as you alluded to, about the efficacy of these drugs. So I would, if I had an opportunity with a divergent payload, I would probably explore such a strategy or prioritize that in the care of a patient like this.
And so this kind of feeds right into this discussion question, which again, this is a data-free zone. So we're sort of thinking about things so we can anticipate them. But do you have concerns? We've seen some data of MIRV to whatever, a lot of folate receptor ADCs, but we've also have prior MIRV on RDXD. MIRV has pneumonitis. Some of these drugs have pneumonitis. Are you thinking I'm sure you are, but how are you thinking about that sequencing of agents where you're going to maybe compound a risk of ILD? How are you thinking about that risk and how you sequence these drugs for our patients?
It's an area where I will humbly say I'm learning in real time. I think many of us are using these agents more frequently, both on trial and as clinical practice. We're sometimes using them in combination, and we're seeing that some of these adverse event profiles, when used in combination, may be different than what we anticipated even when they were used as a single agent, like the ILD rate with some of these drugs. So we've got to think about it. If I can avoid overlapping adverse events, then that would be my preference. Is that feasible? It's hard to know right now because we're learning about these AEs as the number of patients treated with these antibody drug conjugates grows. So, you know, my hope is that we're going to get a better understanding and we'll have the data to guide what we do. But I do envision a future, and Dr. Monk and I have had conversations about this, where we will be using these drugs sequentially and we'll have to make these decisions.
Yep. Well, with that, I'm going to invite Dr. Eskander to the podium to tell us about TROP2 targeted ADCs.
Thank you.
And the clicker's up here for you.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Moore, and thank you all for joining us. I don't think there's a better time to talk about antibody-drug conjugates than following the scientific session that many of us had participated in terms of our ability to listen to excellent presentations looking at the evolving ADC landscape. We're going to be focusing on TROP2-directed antibody-drug conjugates. Dr. Moore already alluded to the fact that this is a dynamic landscape. We make the statement that the slides that we share with you guys today will be outdated 3 months from now, probably 3 weeks from now, quite frankly. And why is that the case? Because when you look at marketed ADC payloads, these are antibody drug conjugates for which there's availability of these agents, you could see that the payload distribution is quite different than the antibody drug conjugate payload distribution in phase 3 trials. So what this is telling us is, look, in real time, from what we've developed and approved to what we're testing in clinical trial today, we are seeing rapid evolution. And we anticipate that this is going to continue to change at a rapid pace because the technology around ADC development is not stopping. So I just want that to sit in the back of our minds as we talk about therapeutic strategies. And when we talk about the GYN malignancy specifically, the tubulins and the topo 1 inhibitors are the most common that we are going to see in development. We also talk about target identification. This is a great image that was adapted from a recently published review, and it highlights a few things. Not all ADC targets are identical. You're going to have antibody drug conjugate targets that are oncogenic drivers. We've seen that. That's an example with HER2. Is that going to behave biologically differently than a non-oncogenic driver target? We don't know yet. We're going to understand that as these trials mature and we see efficacy data. We see ADC targets on neighboring stromal and vascular tissue. And then, of course, we see a slew of ADC targets on the tumor cells themselves, such as TROP2. So when we think about TROP2 as a target, we want to think about ultimately what drove us to look at antibody-drug conjugates. It was this rationale around expanding the therapeutic index. How can I deliver a drug that, if I gave alone, would be intolerable due to toxicity, enriching for drug delivery and efficacy? And so we know TROP2, it is a transmembrane glycoprotein. It was identified on trophoblasts. And if we think back at our days, trophoblasts implant and invade. That's their role in a normal gestation. So as we look at this target, we have preclinical data that suggests that TROP2 is associated with more aggressive biology, invasion, as an example, tumor proliferation. And we also have retrospective data that argues that this antigenic expression is portending a poor prognosis. I will say this is common with many ADC targets, but this is the biologic rationale that helps these targets emerge. Differential expression, prognostication, therapeutic strategy that we can target and implement. And this is the differential expression slide. So if you look here, these are multiple tumor types. And if you look at the very far right, this is the strategy in endometrial cancer. And you could see that there's a very pronounced differential expression in TROP2 between normal tissue as well as malignant tissue. And when you look at the box on the far right on the slide, you could see here that, again, TROP2 is expressed in over 90% of endometrial cancers. So we're trying to take advantage of a rational therapeutic target for which a biological plausibility for efficacy exists. I also want to take a moment to just highlight the fact that we can't sit here and just say all topo 1 targeting or all topo-1 payload ADCs are the same, irrespective of the target. I don't want us to simplify the conversation to that degree. Why? Because the biochemistry around manufacturing these is incredibly complex, and I'm not going to stand up here and tell you that I can explain to you the complexities behind developing these various linkers, where the linker is cleaved, the payload itself, and the nuances between these payloads. But what I will tell you, if you have a TROP2 targeting ADC, there are some similarities, and I'll show you in a slide. The monoclonal antibody may be identical between some of these drugs. There's a cleavable linker, and we understand that the target of the payload is TOPO1, but in the same breath, we know that the payload type is distinct. We know that the specific chemistry of that cleavable linker is distinct. The drug-antibody ratio is going to vary between these drugs. And ultimately, if you follow that little diagram on the right, that's going to inform differential efficacy as well as potentially tolerability. And this ties into the comment we made a moment ago that I don't envision a world where a patient will only get one TOPO1 payload type ADC, because we don't know ultimately after these trials read out what the tolerability and efficacy is going to look like and what data might suggest in sequencing. So let's talk a little bit about these TROP2 targeting ADCs, focusing on the drugs that we have what we believe to be the greatest information to date. So we have sacituzumab govitecan, or SG, we have Dato-DXd, and then we have sacituzumab tromatecan, or SAC-TMT. So if we look at the left, you look at the payloads. Again, these are all targeting TOPO1, SN38, the deruxtecan DXT payload, and then abelotecan-derived TOPO1 inhibitor. You look at the middle column and you look at the drug antibody ratio. Sacituzumab govitecan and SAC-TMT have a similar ratio of about 7.5 to 1, and you look at Dato-DXd, and it's about 4 to 1. And when we look at the adverse event profiles, this is very simplified, you guys. We can go to the comprehensive tables, but for the sake of time, you could see that there's a bit of a tropism for different types of AEs that are going to inform how we mitigate and manage adverse event strategies and inform treatment. So if we talk about TROP2 ADCs in development in endometrial cancer, I just want to highlight the fact again that this is a very rational target because it's differentially expressed and very highly expressed in endometrial cancer, and expression is inversely correlated with differentiation, which is also, again, informing that very aggressive histologies may have poorly differentiated, high expression, and may respond well. So we have, again, SG, Dato-DXd, and SAC-TMT. And a few things we have to think about, this was already alluded to in Dr. Moore's presentation, with prior therapies. What are the implications of prior immune checkpoint? Because it's differentially incorporated in the initial trials informing treatment. What is prior BEV exposure, even in an endometrial cancer population, going to potentially inform? The number of prior lines of therapy. What parts of the world was the data developed in? Because how generalizable is that to our US population? But you could see here, someone might look and say, well, Ramez, how excited should I be? We're seeing ORRs 25%, 30%. Well, firstly, I'll tell you that this data, there's updated data that some of it is shared, some of it will be shared, suggesting that single agent activity is better than what's seen here. But also, I just want to remind everyone that the ORR to single agent chemo in KEYNOTE-775 was 15%. So we can do substantially better. These are two prospective randomized phase 3 trials that were similarly designed comparing TROP2 targeting ADCs, SG, as well as SAC-TMT to physician's choice chemotherapy in patients who had prior chemo and immune checkpoint, looking to improve clinical outcomes. And importantly, both of these trials completed accrual, and we are eager to see what the readout might be, because we need to fill a gap, an unmet medical need in patients who received prior chemotherapy and IO. Importantly, with SAC-TMT in the TroFuse-033 trial, GOG-3119, we see an examination of moving SAC-TMT earlier in lines of therapy, because in the PMMR population, we recognize that chemo and IO helped us make an iterative advance, but can we do better by adding a TROP2 targeting ADC in this paradigm? In the ovarian cancer space, we similarly see therapeutic incorporation of TROP2 ADCs. Why? Because once again, there appears to be differential expression, and you can see here across different ovarian cancer histologies, we have Dato-DXd again, and we have SAC-TMT. We recognize that these studies did allow enrollment of both platinum-sensitive and platinum-resistant patient populations, so it's a little bit of a catch bag, but we see objective responses or overall response rates north of 40%. So we're excited because once again, compared to historical controls, this is provocative and it informs the development of subsequent clinical trials. So once again here, GOG-3101, this is a prospective clinical trial examining TROP2 ADC maintenance in platinum-sensitive recurrent ovarian cancer patient populations. And you could see part one was a safety run-in. At the top, on the bottom, you could see the part two randomized phase three. And if you see again, it's sac-TMT with or without Bev. And again, on the bottom, the physician's choice observation or bevacizumab, depending on the choice of the physician and treatment. And then here again is a phase three TROP2 maintenance in the newly diagnosed non-HRD positive patient population, again, looking to improve upon clinical outcomes because we know that this HRD test negative population continues to need effective therapies, particularly as we've seen the retractions for the PARP withdrawal in this cohort. And just briefly at the end, cervical carcinoma, again, TROP2 expression is elevated in patients with cervical cancer. We recognize this as a rational target. We have preliminary data for both sac-TMT and SG in cervical cancer. And I just want to highlight, you guys, efficacy of 50 to 60%, ORR was 17% with tisotumab vedotin. So let's contextualize this data because it appears to be very exciting from a preliminary perspective. And here, once again, we have incorporation of sac-TMT into a recurrent cervical cancer patient population in GOG-3101 and NGOT-CX20. But also moving it earlier lines of therapy to try to see if we can improve on the KEYNOTE-826 regimen by adding a TROP2 targeting ADC into the care of these patients. And lastly, there's two presentations at this meeting. This is a focused forum session that's on April 13th, tomorrow. And there's another in Scientific Plenary 5, again, sac-TMT plus pembro in recurrent or metastatic cervical cancer. So just in my last two slides, optimal sequencing is yet to be defined. Duration of therapy, Dr. Monk and Dr. Moore taught me dose optimization and regimen optimization, how we have to be thoughtful about these. The idea of cross-resistance, but what we know is TROP2 is validated, is an actionable target in the management of these solid tumors. ADC design will inform efficacy and tolerability. To date in endometrial cancer, the largest data set we have is in TROP2, promising early signals, and of course, the ongoing phase three trials are going to inform standard of care. And lastly, we made this plea, please enroll patients onto these trials because there are many more to come. Thank you so much.
Very good. That was wonderful. I think we shorted you 2 minutes though, Ramaz. So you did a great job coming in on time.
Okay.
You were zooming. All right. So let's go. We're going to get to give us some more time for the case discussion. So I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Monk for his case in endometrial cancer.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Iskander. I really enjoyed that. I'd like the first talk, CDH6. I like the second talk, TROP2, and there are others. But let's try to do some practical discussion here with a patient of mine, first-line ovarian cancer. Yes, I believe in immunotherapy in the PMMR subset. This was a PMMR serous patient who was P53 mutated, low HER2, sometimes they're higher, obviously, in these serous tumors, no POLE, and ER negative, which is also a negative prognostic factor. So she was treated with what I would consider the standard carboplatin paclitaxel NIO. In fact, I want to comment, you talked about these two TROP2 studies in IO-exposed endometrial cancer. I look at them as complementary. They're not competitive. And this KEYNOTE-868 or RUBY, they're complementary, they're not competitive. In fact, the two studies, hopefully TROP2 ADC and IO-exposed endometrial cancer, in here IO in IO-naive, RUBY and 868, really helped drive home the value of here in the first-line checkpoint and hopefully in the second-line TROP2. So is this patient eligible for a TROP2 ADC? It's almost a rhetorical question. Because we don't have that available, but you did show what's called TROFUSE 33 or 3119. She would be eligible for that study. We all know that in PMMR setting, IO is not enough. So let's make it better. And we could make it better with an ADC added in the maintenance phase in this setting, TROP2. So thank you for that.
So let's talk about, let's take the patient that you just presented. So she got what we agree is the standard of care, paclitaxel, carboplatin, and pembrolizumab. And she's finished her maintenance. She's 9 months later, as you say. And so she is eligible for the second line antibody drug conjugate trials sort of across the board. You mentioned that she is, we had a great question from the audience, so I'm gonna weave this in. You mentioned that she's HER2 1 plus, I think that's what you said.
That's right.
And we see, let's make her 1 plus or even 2 plus. We see a lot of use of trastuzumab deruxtecan because of Destiny pan-tumor, and you're gonna speak to this a little bit in the next talk, Dr. Monk. But we see a lot of uptick of that, I wouldn't say just in the community, in our community, just sort of right out of the gates, trying to access these medications for patients, which may be good for them, but also excludes them from subsequent clinical trials of ADCs that might be better if they have low levels of HER2. So how, you know, we're seeing this. Is it just sort of is what it is, and you know, we're doing the best for our patients, or how do you speak to physicians who are desperate for a good medication for their patient, and they have your 1 plus sitting there, they can get it off label. Yeah.
So I pivoted to that patient was eligible for a clinical trial, although that wasn't really the question. The question is, can she get it now? And the answer is no, because the studies that are being done have not yet reported. The 1 plus population, you saw from Dr. Pothuri's very nice presentation of trastuzumab pirmatrecan, that the 1 plus and the 2 pluses did very similar, right? Mm-hmm. So there is a bump in the 3 plus. I can't get it in the 1 plus, but the 1 plus and 2 plus clinically do very similar.
Okay. Yep. Just to add, Katie, to that comment, I know that with NCCN compendium listing, the intent is to broaden access of drugs for patients. But I think you bring up an important point, and we don't quite, I don't think we nail it down as much, which is, if you use a T-DXd and a 1 plus, and we know there's a dose-dependent efficacy difference, Dr. Monk is going to show it, we've seen it, at 1 plus, 2 plus, and 3 plus, that patient may no longer be eligible for an alternate ADC on trial that has what appears to be a benefit, therapeutic benefit that's greater based on a different antigenic biomarker that we're targeting. So it's not that, is it available or not? Yes, I'm hoping that's available for patients, but there can be a sequencing in a rational way so that patient may be exposed to a study on trial and then can go on. To your point, ADC post ADC, what does that mean? We're going to figure it out. I just want to caution us a little bit because there are small data sets that are informing some of these NCCN compendium listings that can impact how we develop effective drugs in the future, and I'm hoping to avoid that.
Yeah, and so just you guys can read the question on the screen. I think everyone can see it. You talked about, but you went through it quickly, so maybe you can restate, if you had 3 or 2 studies of a TROP2 antibody drug conjugate available for your patient, and they always ask us, well, what's the likelihood I'm going to benefit from this? How would you contrast and compare the different TROP2 agents to her without picking a favorite? We always have our favorites, but you have to be careful.
Yeah. This is to me?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think right now, as I alluded to, the table, and I apologize, I was moving quite fast. When we looked at that table and you look at efficacy signals, they range from about 22 to 30%. But again, in a smaller number of patients for each of those, some of them very heavily pretreated patient cohorts, some of them histologies that actually weren't allowed to enroll in the confirmatory phase 3 trials that were completed or were enrolled at a small fraction, as an example, carcinosarcomas. So I would share that information, contextualizing it for the patient because they rely on us to do that so that it can be digestible for them. But I also in the same breath will mention that the trials are designed because we know that single agent chemotherapy has limited efficacy. The other part of this that I always emphasize, I don't treat a patient in clinical practice to an objective response. I'm treating a patient because I value disease control for a long time. I value a tolerable intervention that prevents the disease from growing, which is progression-free survival, not just ORR. So I say, we're still defining that PFS benefit for much of these drugs. We have active studies, and there's short follow-up. I don't know what it's going to look like. So if we treat you, yes, the tumor may shrink by 20%, which is not a defined resist ORR, but guess what? If it shrinks by 20% and I can keep you on a therapy for 8 or 9 months, I feel very happy about that therapeutic intervention that can bridge you to something else.
Right, and that may be the differentiator between many of these drugs is not just response rate, but the duration, which is a surrogate of PFS. And that's really what we We care about everything, but that's what we care about. We can't get through all of these questions on this slide in the interest of time, but let's just, I'll have Dr. Monk take this one. There's, I think our patients are pretty interested in us not giving them chemotherapy. You know, there's this drive to do chemo-free. You heard it actually today by Dr. Gayard again, another chemo-free regimen for our patients. Do you think TROP2 ADCs, or maybe any ADC, can replace paclitaxel carboplatin in the front line as a therapy? Can we de-escalate?
It's speculation. I happen to be in the camp that I don't think it can. I want it to. But platinum taxane, whether it's an endometrial or whether it's an ovarian cancer, has a greater than 50% response rate. So not only do you have to get to that, but you have to be better to beat it. I'm wrong all the time, but personally, I don't think so. That's why most of our strategies have been maintenance. So get your carboplatin paclitaxel, add it to Bev in ovarian non-HRD, or add it to Pembro in the PMMR or dostarlimab endometrial. But I don't know. It needs to be tested, and it will be tested. Can we defeat and do what you want to do, beat carboplatin paclitaxel?
So let's move on to another case, and I'll go through this one a little bit quickly so we can get to Dr. Monk's presentation. This is I didn't make this up. This is one of my real dear patients from Oklahoma. Now I've moved. But she was diagnosed with 3C, high-grade serous ovarian cancer in 2019, received neoadjuvant chemo, got an interval surgery. I added bevacizumab and bevacizumab maintenance for a year, and she finished the year of bevacizumab maintenance no problem. She was BRCA wild type and HRD test positive. This predated just right on the edge of when we had approvals for PARP inhibitors, so she didn't get a PARP. She recurred 24 months after her last platinum-based therapy with liver metastases, and my favorite platinum-sensitive regimen is carboplatin PLD, for 6 cycles with a partial response. And then I started maintenance olaparib for 12 months, maintenance olaparib, and she was pretty stable for about 12 months and then had progression. So then I reinitiated carboplatin for 4 cycles, and unfortunately she progressed on platinum. On workup, she still had liver mets. They never went away. They were a little bigger, but she didn't have any bowel obstruction. She didn't have ascites, mercifully. Her performance status was pretty good. So I re-biopsied at that time and resent next-gen sequencing, and she's, of course, still BRCA wild type. She's still HRD positive, although we know she's functionally, her tumor's functionally not. She was folate receptor alpha medium expression. I think she was like 60% folate, HER2 2+, and TP53Y220C. And she also had an HLA-201, so we do that for bispecifics. So on standard of care, despite all these things, and this was a little bit ago, there were no biomarker-linked FDA-approved medications because her folate was medium, HER2 2+. This is before HER2 is approved anyway. And on trials, we had many things, rosatapop and antibody-drug conjugates. And so what are my considerations for therapy? This harkens back to what Dr. Monk was talking about at the beginning, like how do we think about patients and their treatment when they develop platinum-resistant disease? How many lines of therapy, how many prior platinums is becoming increasingly, I'm tired, important, potentially, and, you know, and how we think about the best therapies for patients. You know, in the day, it was just platinum resistance. Now we're really thinking about lines. What did they receive? Prior bevacizumab, prior PARP inhibitor. Did she progress on a platinum? Did her tumor progress on the platinum or after the platinum was discontinued? Coming back to the point of when do I reinitiate a platinum? And in this case, I'm clearly not going to reinitiate a platinum ever because her tumor has progressed on the platinum. And so this is a patient who's now sitting in front of me, 3 priors, now platinum resistant, good performance status, lots of biomarkers I could pick from. And is this somebody that you'd be thinking about a TROP2 antibody drug conjugate on trial? She's had 1 to 3 priors, measurable disease. Would you go right to rosatapopt if you could get it? I could use off-label TDXD. Here's a 2+. How would you be thinking about her, kind of given the questions on the screen? I'll turn it over to Dr. Eskander.
Yeah, I view this patient as an excellent clinical trial candidate based on the data that you just shared. So if I do have a clinical trial available that's examining a TROP2 ADC, we'll undoubtedly offer it to a patient like this. I think here we're very fortunate again. Why? Because not only would I have the option for a TROP2 ADC trial, I may then sequence and have an option for Y220C enrollment for a patient like this, knowing that she is HER2 2+, and that T-DXd as an NCCN compendium strategy is available to me subsequent to that. And so I think this really, in my mind, underscores this idea that we're thinking, Dr. Monk likes sports analogies, I say we're thinking five plays ahead. We can't just think about right now, but we've got a plan for the subsequent strategies. And in a patient like this, we have the ability to do so, which is wonderful.
Any thoughts from you, Dr. Monk?
So briefly, if you follow the approval, this patient would not be eligible for B96 based on number of lines of therapy. Doesn't mean you couldn't give it. But I look at this as a relacorilant patient, which has a 4.65 hazard ratio for ORS. This has an opportunity for longer survival with an oral, very tolerable regimen. Weekly pack is not tolerable. So that's what I would think of. I like the clinical trial opportunity. The problem is you're gonna lose the clinical trial opportunity because most are three priors, right? So I would sort of counsel her. I like Merv Bev a lot. I like Merv Bev a lot. And I also like TDXD a lot. Mm-hmm. So remember how easy I told you it was? This isn't easy. So this is an opportunity. Really, this consultation can take you an hour. Mm-hmm. And this should be a consultation with the family, and probably the decision shouldn't be made today. You should digest the patient, the family should digest the results, and I'll meet you in a few days to go over it again. This is a tough one.
Yeah, I mean, those of you that take care of patients are sending whatever your Caris or Tempus or whatever, you're finding these.
Right.
HER2 2+, folate medium. Y220C is only 4%, so this really was
a little unicorn
gift. Yeah, a little bit of a unicorn. but what an amazing thing to kind of sit there and go, I have at least four regimens now, including relacorilant, which wasn't an option when this patient was seen in this setting, with the expectation that each one of them should work, and I should get her to the next line of therapy without drop-off. You know, so that idea of sequencing is luxury that we've never really had. You use your best thing, and then, you know, you didn't expect someone to go from Doxil to something else, PLD, sorry. So this is a little bit of a blessing. A blessing, not a burden. Which is the right one for her at which time, I think, is something we don't know.
One very brief additional point is if I had a single-arm phase 2 like you did with DS6000, where she's not going to get randomized, I think it becomes easier to go on a clinical trial rather than a phase 3 where the...
Right.
Right? Right. And you have a lot of those.
Which is what I have, yeah. So.
Right, and so do I, and that's why you do what you do.
Yeah.
It becomes much easier.
So this patient was predated. She's actually still doing very well. This patient predated the studies that are going on now, but say at the time she was platinum sensitive, so she was HRD positive, she'd never seen a PARP, but she was BRCA wild type, so she missed that opportunity. It's actually not on label anymore, so I can't give her a PARP. Mm-hmm. So she would have gotten still carboplatin PLD, but she might have been a candidate for maintenance therapy. So is this someone that you would have thought about in that setting to be potentially a participant on a maintenance therapy? Is there anything about liver metastases or anything else that would have made you worried about her? Or would you have been comfortable with an ADC instead of platinum as a platinum-sensitive option for her?
I would have been comfortable to treat with a therapeutic strategy that incorporated an ADC in this patient without feeling compelled.
Because the reason I said I don't think we can defeat platinum and taxane because it was in the front line. Yeah. This patient progressed on a PARP. The activity of retreatment with platinum here is probably lower, which means it's probably more appropriate to treat single agent PARP. ADC.
And then before we move on to your presentation, Dr. Monk, this is sort of the last question. We've talked a lot about relutatug and really CDH6 targeting and TROP2. What we heard at the scientific session other options. Just briefly, each of you, what are you excited about other than these that are coming into clinical trials? What makes you really excited?
We can't forget about still FR-alpha as a valid target with novel ADCs that are in development that we heard about. We certainly know about B7H4 emerging in terms of therapeutic efficacy, both in endometrial cancer as well in ovarian cancer. I think if we think about, we can name others. We saw the data on B7H3 earlier today. Claudin-6 has emerged, and there's data about Claudin-6, also the therapeutic strategy. But it's hard. I try in my mind to think about those that might be furthest along and have the most mature data. But those are the ones that come to the forefront of my mind.
Yep. All right. Well, I'm going to turn the podium over to Dr. Monk. Thank you, everyone.
That's great. Thank you. I'm having fun. So I think Dr. Moore and Dr. Viskander, I think it's definitely hope. It's not hype. But the fact is we don't have that many ADCs approved yet. We have three. I'll show you on my next slide. We wanted to sort of highlight the validated targets, the agents that we have, folate receptor alpha, HER2, and TROP2. And then we wanted to sort of be provocative, and that's why Dr. Moore led off with the CDH6. What you said, Dr. Iskander, we could have spent that same time for B7H4. B7H4 is also a very interesting target. Several agents in the clinic. We just didn't have the time to do it. I think all of the biomarkers, all the ADCs probably will be biomarker informed. I get it that tisotumab vedotin isn't, so there are probably a few exceptions. But the issue is, does it really matter? What you have taught us, Dr. Moore, and with mirvetuximab is, yes, high folate receptor alpha is important, but it works in the mediums and the lows. And same with T-DXd, yes, 3+ is better than 2+, but 2+ pretty good. So you can see the gradation here on the top. The pink is the H&E stain, and then below the darker is immunohistochemistry looking at the higher expression. And I'm going to synthesize some of this, and that's what I like to do. Folate receptor alpha is a valid target. Thank you, Dr. Moore. Thank you, you, that did it, okay? And so we have three folate receptor alpha agents in the clinic. They're unique, though, in two, maybe several ways. But the first is that they seem to be active regardless of the biomarker. The other is that they're unique in that they are topoisomerase linker payloads. We talked about that. So you'll have access. I made that slide, by the way. I'm very proud of it. Is that you'll have access to these slides. And if you don't know how to convert a PDF to a PowerPoint, we can teach you. It's pretty simple. this oncology pipeline, what there are individual websites where you can go and sort of get the data. And so I just copied it, and that's the source. And you can see these folate receptor alpha ADCs. You can see the phase 3 trials, all of which are basically ongoing. You can see the overall response rate in the all-comer and certainly the highs, but it's really the lows and mediums that we're excited about. So that's a nice opportunity. I'm not going to talk too much about trastuzumab deruxtecan because Dr. Iskander already did, but I want to illustrate sort of the learning points from that from a toxicity standpoint. You know that we have it in all tumor types in the 3+ and NCCN recommended in the 2+ based on these pretty exciting results. There's words on this, but this is so instructional, and maybe I owe it to my two friends on the left, but the treatment-related adverse events are mostly related to the linker payload, not to the target, right? So if you take a linker payload, such as vedotin, tisotumab vedotin, and you look at the other enfortumab vedotin, okay, and so on, the adverse events are pretty much the same, even though one's nectin-4 and one's tissue factor. Same with deruxtecan, it's the same thing. So RDXD, it's not exactly TDXD, but it's close. So the other sort of teaching point, and I think we all get it, but we can teach each other and our trainees, that the tubulins are very different than the tubulins. the tubulins are very different than the topoisomerase. And there's sort of a theme here. The tubulins have more peripheral neuropathy, and you know how to manage that. And the topoisomerase have more intestinal. And so, for example, TDXD is a highly emetogenic chemotherapy and it needs to be mitigated with triple therapy, NK1, 5-HT3, and 3 days of Dex. So the expression, the exception is that there are TROP2, and I'm going to show you. And then there's some unique ones, almost idiosyncratic, the ocular and the pneumonitis. But this is, you can learn a lot. I'm a lumper, a grouper, because I'm not smart enough to remember all the exceptions. I want to remember the rule. So these are the sort of drugstaccan linker payload. And I want to put GI at the top. They didn't really emphasize it because they know how to use highly emetogenic antiemetics. So highly emetogenic prophylactic regimens. I'm going to also say for Dato that we talk about Dato, but not really. Why is Dato not being developed in GYN? It's an easy answer. Because the sponsors, the dual sponsors, have other assets, other molecules that they're studying, and they don't want to compete against themselves. So it's not that Dato is not a good TROP2 antibody drug conjugate. It's just that the sponsors have deprioritized it. I don't know why, Katie, you said that. I'm a lumper. If you look at the TDXD and the RDXD starting doses and the dose reductions, I don't know why we just can't all be the same because they're so close. I'm going to skip through this because I want to keep going here. So this is another slide I'm proud of. So, and I want you to have these. That's cool, right? You got the SAC-TMT, you got the SAC-CHI, you have this sort of the cartoons, the differences. And again, I look at these as complementary. And you would never hear from me that 868 or GY018 is better than Ruby or vice versa. But I will tell you that I believe in IO and PMMR first-line endometrial cancer because they're complementary. These will also be complementary results, I hope. They will be a little bit divergent. Dostarlimab and pembrolizumab, very similar. These are not similar. They're identical antibodies, but very distinct linker payloads, as they talk about here. And if you go to the next slide, let's just go here. I don't know what happened here. So I just want to, because I want to talk about adverse events. Let's just say this is with SAC-TMT. So if you look at sort of as a general rule, SAC-TMT has oral mucositis. Not a lot. 5 to 10%. Sacituzumab govitecan had diarrhea. Not a lot. But those are distinct differences. They have almost identical GI and heme. Well, what are the other differences between SAC-G and SAC-TMT? Well, SAC-TMT is given 2 doses every 4 weeks. You mean like every other week, Monk? Yeah, I mean. And SAC-G is given 2 doses every 3 weeks, just to put it in perspective. So 1-8-21. And so you got now different side effect profiles, you have different schedules, and the efficacy, I have no idea, but I bet they're both going to be pretty good. So I hope that we can have that for you very soon. I'm going to sort of wrap this up. I just would be remiss to remind us that in ovarian cancer, we have a wonderful new approval, as you know, on February 10. We have another wonderful approval. That's of March 25th. So I'm bouncing around, but again, these are similar weekly taxane regimens. My talk here is on toxicity. But the adverse event profile, the eligibility for B96 and Rosella are different. So we have to integrate. We have a lot of moving parts, and I'm so honored. This is my favorite meeting. We have a lot of medical oncologists here, a lot of radiation oncologists, but this is the Society of Gynecologic Oncology. It's not the Society of Gynecologic Oncologists, but I like specialty that specializes in cancer, and that's us. So I'll stop there, made up a little time. I want to thank you for enrolling in these trials. We are in a very congested landscape because we have all these studies, especially ADCs, and that's a good thing. Thank you.
All right, let's do some cases, and hopefully we'll get some more questions up on toxicity. I'm going to start us off with a case. So this is another case. You can tell because I made this is my format. So this is a patient with which is great, stage 4 high-grade endometrioid ovarian cancer, had neoadjuvant chemo, received niraparib here for a year. This is actually the same patient. I'm continuing her. So same patient as before. You can see her biomarkers. I offered her weekly paclitaxel because we didn't have relacorilant at the time versus a novel antibody-drug conjugate. And she actually went on to one of the early clinical trials that's now completed of relutotug deruxtecan. And it worked great. I showed you the response rates before. She's one of those waterfalls on the waterfall plot. She had a deep partial response that was confirmed after 4 cycles, comes in for cycle 6, really just feeling well, which I think a lot of our antibody drug conjugates, that for those of you that have clinical trials, this is sort of what we see. Patients kind of walk in really looking like themselves. It's really nice. They walk in. They're not wheeled in. So she's feeling great. And I get her CT scan up. And everything's still smaller, but she has new ground glass opacities bilaterally. Reviewed the prior scans, and they were indeed new. Totally asymptomatic, normal pulse ox. She feels and looks great. I had to tell her to hold, which does not go over well. And someone that has progressed with liver metastases and is quite scared, and now everything's shrinking, and she feels great. And I think it was like approaching the holidays, and I'm like, yeah, we can't treat. And I need you to see pulmonology and do all these tests. And so she had to be seen by pulmonology. I started steroids, which we can talk about. And her ground glass opacities did resolve within about 4 weeks. That's when I re-scanned her, and we can talk about that. And I restarted her at a dose modification, and she was ongoing at the time I left my prior institution, which was a few months ago, at cycle 12 with a continued partial response. So when we talk about pneumonitis and ILD, we use those terms interchangeably, but pneumonitis is like a subset of ILD. All pneumonitis is ILD, but not all ILD is pneumonitis. And so she had pneumonitis.
True.
And this is how she presented. So let's talk a little bit about pneumonitis with these ADCs, maybe as compared to what we saw with pembrolizumab. What, you know, Dr. Eskander, what do you think about the incidence and severity of what we're seeing with RDXD or TDXD, or similar payloads compared to other ADCs, kind of across the board? What's your sense of the prevalence of pneumonitis with ADCs?
We do see, to some degree, a difference depending on the payload, DXDs versus non-DXD payloads. I think you don't recognize what you don't know to look for. And I think what we've learned in the context of the clinical trials that we have active and ongoing, and in addition, the utilization of approved ADCs like mirvetuximab, which is an MMAE payload, but we recognize that now that this is on the radar, I will just say personally, I have a new respect for ground glass opacities. I'm much more apt to look at the CT images myself and make sure. Now, I'm not a radiologist by default, of course, but I'm much more inclined to make sure I'm not seeing something that will make me call my radiologist and say, hey, can you please take a look at this again? Because I want to make sure that what I'm seeing isn't reflective of ILD. Why? Because I will venture to say, I bet every one of us on the stage is admitted a patient to the hospital with treatment-associated ILD, and these patients can have very rapid clinical deterioration. In fact, 2 weeks ago, I had a patient who was admitted, got her treatment in the infusion center, had a pulse ox checked after infusion, and it was 85%, and it was normal everything prior to that, went to the hospital, and within 3 days was on heated high flow and had to have high-dose steroids started. Bronch, everything workup, it was treatment-associated ILD. Thank God, the nurse in the infusion checked center, checked the pulse ox. She went straight to the hospital, was admitted, and the intervention initiated because someone like that could very quickly have a more rapid clinical deterioration. So it's just, for me, the take-home message is we are going to see these things, and the more we use these drugs, we're going to encounter it in clinical practice. So it's having a low threshold and index of suspicion and intervening early. You're never going to regret that, but please don't ever ignore any of your clinical suspicions or concerns.
So you said something at the beginning, just to reemphasize, because it feeds into this next question about screening techniques. If you're using a medication, any ADC until we know more, your screening technique is high-res chest CT or just chest CT? What are you ordering?
Yeah, so we, by our default CT, when I order a CT chest with contrast, is a high-resolution CT chest at our institution.
No matter what.
Now, I don't know whether it's like that for everybody at their respective sites. I think it's prudent to ask your radiologist to figure it out. But for us, and maybe part of that is because of the population that we're serving and the number of trials that we have open and treating patients on, because the imaging studies are the same, that are done, but they're high-resolution CT imaging with contrast.
The low-resolution CTs are the ones that are done with the PET scan. The low-resolution CTs are the ones that are done for lung cancer screening. But when you order a diagnostic CT, it's, high-res.
And before we move on to this one, this patient was grade 1, right? She's asymptomatic, just ground glass opacities. Dr. Monk, how are you treating those individuals that are presenting with just purely asymptomatic new findings? Pulmonologist says, yep, that's new. Are you letting it resolve and just holding for 4 weeks? Are you starting for steroids? And if steroids, what dose are you using?
So the recommendation for TDXT, because that's what we have, is for the grade ones, you don't have to treat. But when we use TDXT, we actually feel a sense of urgency because we're treating active cancer. So although for the breast cancer world, where it's more of an adjuvant long term, in the GYN space, when you got grade 1, you should treat. And the grade 1s, again, are asymptomatic. You treat with a lowish dose, 0.5 mg/kg/day of, let's say, prednisone. Okay, but for symptomatic, what you said, high dose. The other thing is all ILD is not treatment related, COVID, all sorts of things. So I know how to treat ILD, but I don't know how to exclude the other causes. And so I always ask Pulm to see her, and I basically tell them, I need to make sure that I'm not giving an infectious case of pneumonia steroids, immunosuppression, when I should give her antibiotics. It's a very important distinction because the treatments are divergent. In the sick patient, frankly, she'll generally get both, because she's not going to get bronched this minute. So they'll actually give her some community-acquired antibiotic and a milligram or milligram and a half, because they don't want to happen to what. So they're pretty aggressive, and the breast cancer doctors can help you if you're not familiar with how to handle TDXT-related ILD.
Dr. Eskander, why don't I turn it over to you for your case?
All right, we'll go through this a bit quickly. This is a 70-year-old, excellent performance status, very healthy patient who came in with postmenopausal bleeding, appropriately had an endometrial biopsy that showed a high-grade lesion with serous features on endometrial biopsy. The testing that was done on the EMB showed a TP53 mutation, mismatch repair proficient, HER2-IHC 2+ ERPR negative. Radiographic imaging showed evidence of metastatic disease as well as an anterior pericardiophrenic lymph node, pericaval and AP window lymph nodes, which, by the way, were biopsied and confirmed to be intrathoracic metastases. We're seeing more of these patients who present with widely metastatic endometrial cancer. So she was actually started on neoadjuvant chemotherapy plus immune checkpoint inhibition, an adaptation of the trials that Dr. Monk alluded to a moment ago. She had 3 cycles, and radiographic imaging showed, again, an excellent radiographic response. Throughout this process, she did remarkably well clinically. So she was taken to the operating room basically to resect her primary site of disease and the omentum, which had a disease on it at the time of initial diagnosis, radiographically as well. Surgical pathology showed TMB low, mismatch repair proficient, which we knew previously, PD-L1 negative, PIK3R1A mutation, TP53, not a Y220C, and a PP2R1A mutation. PATH actually showed a uterine carcinosarcoma, with the epithelial component being serous and some clear cell features. She did still have evidence of metastatic disease in some of the areas that were resected. She had 3 additional cycles and then was put on maintenance pembrolizumab. 6 months after initiation of maintenance therapy, unfortunately, she had evidence of radiographic disease recurrence with peritoneal carcinomatosis, small volume ascites, confirmed recurrent disease by biopsy, excellent ECOG performance status, prior carbotaxol, pembro maintenance progressing at 6 months after initiation of maintenance pembro. And when I re-biopsied, it was HER2 zero plus.
What does that even mean?
I know, I don't know why they did the HER2 again, but they did on the biopsy and it was zero plus, which informed my counseling of this patient. So we did have the ASCENT GYN01 GOG3104 clinical trial open, discussed the trial. This patient was randomized onto study and was randomized to the therapeutic investigational arm with single agent SG. She started in February of 2025. Fatigue, constipation, ECOG performance status remains zero. And thankfully, as Dr. Moore's patient on trial had a deep and durable response, as is this patient right now. So it's exciting for her.
So that's great. I mean, this is why we do clinical research. These are like the patients that you just like, I made a good decision today. Because sometimes you don't, right? But let's talk about TROP2 ADCs. We kind of went through it a little bit quickly in Dr. Monk's presentation, and they are different. And you've made this point several times, Dr. Eskander. When you're thinking about, let's talk about the two most proximal potential drugs, sacituzumab and sacituzumab, both targeting TROP2, both camptothecin payloads, decidedly different linkers. So can you just take us through how you think about toxicity management on SASI-G versus what you're thinking about on SASI-TMT? Ramiz.
Yeah. So I know Dr. Monk summarized it towards the end of his talk. You know, there's a few considerations. I will say that, as was already alluded to, hematologic adverse events and GI adverse events can occur with both of these antibody-drug conjugates. This kind of tropism for a mucositis or stomatitis we're seeing with sac-TMT can be mitigated with appropriate strategies, including a mouth cooling device, which if you guys aren't aware of, please reach out, because as you use TROP2 targeting ADCs, you may experience this, and there's things that we can do to make sure patients' symptoms are manageable. But from an SG perspective, you also have patients that may have a UGT1A1 homozygous alteration, and those patients may be at increased susceptibility for developing an AE such as diarrhea or significant anemia. Mm-hmm. And also use of growth factors may be required with these drugs. So I know we could talk about this for a very long time, but that's a short answer to a complicated question.
And just coming back to you, Dr. Monk, when you were kind of zooming through SAC-TMT, can you just restate for counseling, how do you counsel patients about the risk of stomatitis?
Yes, yeah, so the mouth cooling device, which I'm a big fan of, it basically is a balloon that's cool and it expands the gums and covers the mucosa. It's inconvenient, so I don't use it until there's grade 2. So the intention is, you know, grade 1's not really debilitating. It's not very serious. Don't need to do anything. It's like grade 1 ILD. But in grade 1 ILD, we do something. But when I have grade 2, I want to now activate this so that I can maintain dose intensity. I tell the patient that it's a 10 to 20% chance. I've been on some luck here lately, and I'm not sure. I really believe that these adverse events, sort of the fit patient, good oral hygiene, everybody gets dexamethasone, you know, mouthwash. Those patients are good, but it's sort of the frail, maybe even the dentition issue, maybe even a smoker that has some of these mucosal dental issues that are, I don't really know that, but you know, I've treated quite a few patients.
So how is the, because in this chart that you put up on SAC-TMT for the 2 dose levels, and you went through it a little bit quickly, I don't know if I can get back to it, the stomatitis risks were about 40% all grade. So was that before prophylaxis? Because I guess
that
I'm
was before
confused
prophylaxis.
About
that was
20 versus 40%.
Great point. That was in the Chinese population. Thank you. And that's why I didn't dwell on it. It was a Chinese population without any mitigation. All patients in our studies get, I don't think ice chips really work, but they do get ice chips and dexamethasone mouthwashes.
And how about that? There are ocular toxicities both with Dato-DXd, which maybe we won't focus as much on because it's not being moved forward. But sac-TMT, there's an ocular mitigation plan. Can you go through that and maybe compare and contrast to mirvetuximab, soravtansine, and tisotumab vedotin?
It's a good point. So we didn't think there was until there was. And so it now is in an adverse event of special interest. We don't require ongoing eye exams, but we monitor the patient symptomatically. It's low, but we take it very seriously, very different than the mirvetuximab or the tisotumab vedotin AEs, where we're ocular events and steroid and lubricant eye drops are required. It's a good question. They're not very many people that know that, but this is Dr. Moore, and she's absolutely right. It is something that we take very seriously in the development, again, ocular and ILD.
So the last question, then I'm going to let you guys go because it's top of the hour. This is a really good question, and I'm going to admit to not knowing the answer. So any warnings or words of wisdom regarding metabolism and contraindicated medications with any of these ADCs that clinicians should be aware of, like CYP3A metabolism or QTC prolongation? Ram, Dr. Eskander, I mean, other than what you mentioned about the UGT1, are there any things that you can think about? We're following QTC on all these clinical trials,
Yeah. But
I think that's an FDA requirement. I guess I'm not sure if there's a known
I'm not aware risk. Of one. I will tell you, though, essentially every trial has a list of potential drug classes that may cause interactions. So I really lean on my investigational drug services pharmacy. We go through it. We have their list of current meds to make sure. Do I know exactly what those interactions are, meaning risk associated? I don't know, to be honest, and I'm not aware of anything that comes to my mind right now.
Yeah, but as a general rule, topoisomerase payloads do not have sort of the CYP3A restriction generally, but we're very, very sensitive about that. And we've seen same thing as a class. Remember, I'm a lumper, right? So as a class effect, we have not seen QTC prolongation, although we do a lot of EKGs.
All right. So that was a tough question to end on. Someone kind of stumped us there.
Yes.
Good job. So that about wraps up our program. And thank you very much for your attention. And please enjoy the rest of the meeting. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.